Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Savitt, who's a visiting scholar in Chinese Media Studies at Duke University. He's a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and United Press International, and his forthcoming memoir is on his two decades as an American reporter in China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Savitt.
Oh, thank you, Ian.
And we've heard, of course, from the New York Times, who have had considerable problems with the Chinese government of late since they revealed the immense fortunes of the Chinese leaders, that there is this building on Great Harmony Road outside of Shanghai that is the headquarters of the Chinese military's cyber warfare unit. And, of course, this has come as no surprise to anybody who's known that Chinese military are behind a lot of the hacking that's been going on. So given that it's not necessarily a new story, what is your takeaway from it?
I just got off the phone with one of the authors of the Mandiant report that the New York Times story is based on. And So this is a little bit of exclusive information for your listeners. Is the reason this came out is because the U.S. government was getting ready to reveal this, and they tipped their hat to, you know, this quasi private. The Mandiant is the leading cyber security firm based in D.C. They have the guy I talked to was one of my former reporters in Beijing. He's military intelligence, still active, actually. So a lot of military people working for them. And the U.S. government was going to reveal this, so they allowed this private entity to issue this report first. The problem with it is when you issue this report, you reveal your sources and methods. So the Chinese are going to change up as a result of this. So you would prefer not to do that. There's nothing new in this information. This is all very well known in the industry. The only thing that's happening now is, you know, you read it in the New York Times. Otherwise, this is standard operating procedure now. Military powers gather information on each other, and that's going to continue.
But what is alarming people from this New York Times Mandiant report is that this People's Liberation Army Unit 61398 apparently is targeting or planning to target U.S. critical infrastructure such as refineries, power stations, waterways, etc.
Well, we do that too. Actually, that's what you want your military to do. And the point is that you can claim that it's purely defensive in nature. This is what I'm emphasizing, is that, you know, it may have made very, exciting reading in your morning New York Times, but actually for people in the industry, there's nothing new about this, and that, you know, we're doing it to each other. Everybody knows. It's a little bit amateur for them to have been found out this way, you know, so people could just go right up to the building. That shows that they're getting a little more bold, because I think they would have done it behind military compound gates where, you know, nobody could have identified it previously. So, you know, that means something is different. And, you know, my guy at Mandiant just said, yeah, it means they're almost really not trying to hide it anymore. They don't care who knows. And you know, in terms of the incursions in the South China Sea with Japan, you know, playing chicken with Japan and painting, you know, their ships with radar, the Chinese, it's brinksmanship. And you know, this is what's alarming people. And, you know, the people I most respect, the analogy they use is this is Japanese militarism a la 1930s. And, you know, this is what probably the civilian leadership in China doesn't have complete control of the PLA.
Well, Scott Savitt, I'd like to get a sense of what that relationship is between the civilian leadership and the Chinese military. There was some doubt as to whether the new leader was going to even get the defense portfolio there for a while. I guess.
Well,
go ahead. Sorry.
He was always going to get the defense portfolio. It was just a question of time, and you know, that's the part of the succession. They've institutionalized the leadership succession. The way it works is the guy in from Deng Xiaoping chose this guy, and then you know, they skip generations. So it was a compromise for Jiang Zemin to come in between the, you know, their various factions in leadership, and so you get to pick not your successor, but the successor of your successor. So that's where we are now. And the only thing that's not completely procedural is when he assumes this central military commission censorship, which has always been where that's why Chairman Mao was called Chairman Mao. That's, you know, the commander-in-chief is where the real power lies. I mean, you know, you're the leader, you're the de facto leader of the Communist Party, but controlling the People's Liberation Army is what is considered most significant. And, you know, it's already a done deal. What you heard was just conjecture, but everybody, you know, they horse traded and everybody said, okay, we'll all retire together. So in the at the March National People's Congress, Xi Jinping will take over the chairmanship of the Central Military Commission. And that, you know, that's not subject to question, but just because he has the title doesn't really mean anything. You know, the previous leaders, Deng Xiaoping, obviously, he was a Long March veteran. He was, you know, he was a military commander. He fought in the Civil War. So, you know, he had those credentials. And every generation since has had less credibility with the military. Up to this one, the most that this guy can claim is that his father was a Long March veteran. But other than that, you know, you're going to have young military guys the same age as him saying, why am I going to take orders from this guy? You know, and this is the danger. This is why single-party states have a difficult time with succession because, you know, in our country, you have an election and, you know, the president is the commander-in-chief and, you know, it's treason if you disobey an order. And even then you find out that there are people who, you know, don't like it. But, you know, so far nobody's there. You know, no coups in this country that were aware, or maybe there were. Who knows? But you know, in China, it's much more dicey.
Again, I'm speaking with Scott Savitt, who's a visiting scholar in Chinese media studies at Duke University. He's a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and the United Press International, and his forthcoming memoir is on his two decades as an American reporter in China. Well, Deng Xiaoping, of course, was the one who made the transition from communism to capitalism with a Chinese face. And part of what he did was encourage the military to go into business in order to pay for their own budget. And this has led to them being not just politically independent or in a murky kind of way, but also, to some extent, economically independent, although you said earlier that they get what they want at any rate. But my understanding is that, you know, there's some powerful dynasties within the military, like the Yang family. So,
very powerful. So, yeah, just to clarify, so Deng came to power after the Cultural Revolution. You know, this was with the military's backing. So Mao died, the Gang of Four, led by Mao's wife, is left in place, and within a month of Mao's death, they're under arrest. You know, Deng comes in with, you know, the Yang family, as you mentioned. I mean, these are the people who, you know, made it possible for him to take power. So starting from then, the fact that the military is involved in business is just, that was given because, you know, China opened up to Western investment and the military was one of the most powerful institutions. And, you know, they did have all kinds of sprawling empires. Like, you know, the brothels in Beijing were run by the military. I mean, crazy, crazy stuff. And so in the 1990s, after Tiananmen, they finally said, okay, you know, this is really unseemly. So they made a big push of the military getting out of private business. But all they did was put up front companies. I mean, you know, they're still... It's the largest, most powerful entity in China. They have, you know, they have their own food supply network. They have their own military airport system. They have their own telecommunication system. It's almost like, you know, they make the joke about Pakistan. They say it's not a country with an army; it's an army with a country. And there's a little bit of truth in that in China as well. So. Like I said, the analogy people are using is 1930s Japan, where the civilian leaders really are not in control of the military. And I, you know, with North Korea, with Japan, they, you know, they have plausible deniability with all of this. And so it's very difficult to know. But, you know, I argue with people all the time who try and say, oh, no, the Chinese, they really don't want North Korea. Well, come on, North Korea can't even survive a day without Chinese assistance. So... under those circumstances, how can you, you know, simultaneously say you're propping up a regime, but they won't listen to you? It doesn't make sense. Never mind all the, you know, all the technology comes from China anyway. So,
well, Scott Sabat, what happened at Tiananmen, though? Because I got the impression that the Chinese, the politicians, didn't know what to do. You know, they'd created a mess with Hu Yaobang's death and the student democracy movement that sprung up out of that, and then they got rid of the progressive leader Zhao Zhang, and then the military sort of saved their bacon, exacted a price, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So basically, what you had was a divided civilian leadership, as you probably have now. And the thing is that, you know, I remember this very, very, I mean, I was a cub reporter, I was 24 years old, but the thing was that, you know, when the students started marching, I said, oh, they're going to crack their heads and it's going to be over, but nobody gave the order, and one day there were a dozen, and the next day there were a million people in the street. I mean, literally that quickly. And then it was something that the civilian leadership really couldn't deal with. So they had to bring the military in, and they had to make a Faustian bargain. And, they declared martial law. They gave the order, come on in, and really put a fright into these people. So, they don't dare to do it for another couple decades where we are now. And in the meantime, the military has gotten everything that they've wanted. You look who benefits. The military budget has increased annually. Nobody really says no to them. And now you have a situation where, you know, everybody's saying China's belligerence, it looks counterproductive. Why are they being so aggressive? And the only logical explanation is the military is calling the shots.
So, in other words, the fact that China holds our debt, that there's a huge amount of trade going on, that China's trade is international and they're taking more and more of a role on the world stage, you're not of the belief that it's inevitable that the military competition will recede as economic competition and interconnectedness increases? That's the conventional
wisdom. Oh, no, on the contrary. I mean, they go hand in hand. This is tearing incognito, because you had a Cold War with the Soviets, but we didn't have trillions of dollars of trade with them. You know, the whole thing about the debt, that's a red herring, because the Chinese, they have nothing else to do with that money but buy our treasury bonds. You know, we're mutually interdependent. So, you know, that one is just, it's a mistaken notion, but the trade is very significant. But this, you know, this idea that just because, you know, you have a massive amount of trade means that militaries don't compete, it doesn't make any sense. They both go on simultaneously. It doesn't stop the militaries from competing for supremacy. And the point is that, you know, the U.S. has been accustomed to being the sole superpower, and, you know, the China is the one entity that can challenge them, and asymmetric warfare makes it possible for you know, them to leapfrog, and that's exactly what's happening. That's what you're witnessing with all of this.
Yep. So, Scott, I thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, that's right. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Savitt, who's a visiting scholar in Chinese Media Studies at Duke University. He's a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and United Press International, and his forthcoming memoir is on his two decades as an American reporter in China. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how a number of states are losing revenues to tax havens.